Welcome to Christ the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. My name is Camden Busey, and this is episode number 834. I'm in Libertyville, Illinois, back for another excellent conversation. No doubt it will be here on the podcast. I'm looking forward to having a conversation with our guest today, who is none other than Dr. Owen Anderson, who is a professor of philosophy, religious studies, and theology at Arizona State University, as well as a pastor at Historic Christian Church of Phoenix, Arizona. Welcome to the program, Owen. It's great to see you.
Thanks for having me on. I'm super excited to talk with you.
Yes. Well, I am as well. I know that we, for everyone else who wants to know, we got to meet each other at the Presbyterian Scholars Conference in Wheaton, Illinois, where I meet all sorts of interesting and fun people. We had a wonderful conversation and getting to know you a bit, and then started looking at your website and your writings and all sorts of other things. There's a million things we could talk about, and I'm hopefully we're going to be able to open up many of those today. The presenting topic, at least, is going to be the First Amendment and religious liberty, and you've edited a Cambridge Companion on that. So we're also going to talk about, no doubt, your chapter in that book. But even before that, there's all sorts of current event topics. We didn't plan this back in October when we first met, but since then, recently, in terms of when we're recording, there was some congressional testimony from various Ivy League presidents on matters of freedom of speech on campus and whether it's okay to, I don't know, whether talk about or calls for genocide are permissible under, considered free speech under codes of conduct at universities. But before we get into maybe touch points with current events, I'm curious just about your academic experience. I mean, I can go through the list and people can head on over to drowenanderson.com, Dr. Owen Anderson, that's S-O-N. The proper way to spell it, right, Owen?
Right.
You can head over there for more detailed information. But my goodness, when we first met, you were just off the heels of some interaction with David Prager and issues regarding faculty at ASU. Why don't you give us a little bit of an introduction as to what's been going on in your life lately?
Yeah, let me suggest to my Substack, which is just Dr. Owen Anderson at Substack, where I keep track. It's turned into kind of a journalistic site to just document the kinds of things that are happening at ASU as a secular university, because I don't think parents and students, and I actually started writing them recently to pastors in the area, I don't think they're aware of how political. I mean, if you said, is ASU political? Sure. Mm-hmm. State schools are political. We know that. Mm-hmm. I don't think you realize how political it is. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, this year I've gotten involved in free speech issues because in the early part of the year, Dennis Prager was going to come speak on campus, and the vast majority of our honors professors wrote a letter about how he shouldn't be allowed to speak at the Honors College because he's a white nationalist bigot. And the proof they gave was
I'm not saying because I agree, but I'm just saying what they said.
You're just listening, that's what even worth pausing at. White nationalist bigot, right. Dennis Prager.
Yeah,
I mentioned that
conservative Jewish man. Yeah.
Yeah, and he said, that's the first time I've been called that. But the startling thing was just that there, all of the evidence they gave was from Media Matters, which, of course, is like a left-wing. So it'd be like a right-wing person thinking Breitbart proves their point, right?
Right.
So they gave that. And what it meant was, if you're conservative, in his case Jewish, but he holds a lot of views that overlap with Christians, especially about marriage, because that's the thing they focused on, is that he's bigoted about marriage. If he can't speak, then really the conservative, biblical Christian can't speak at ASU anymore. So I got involved at that point to say, wait a minute, clearly we need to defend his right to speech.
Yeah, sure. Well, even today, I wasn't able to get into the details, but I saw at least headlines regarding the Pope offering blessings for homosexual unions. So I haven't dove in to consider what the details are there, but maybe the Pope would be allowed to speak at ASU now.
I'm sure. No, I'm pretty sure they'd be excited about that. But the idea is basically it's not, I don't think the issues really are political. I think the issue is someone like Dennis Prager believes that Genesis is inspired and Genesis teaches God is the one who ordains marriage, not the state. And so you can't change the definition of marriage through the state. And because he believes those things, he's not welcome to speak in the secular university.
Oh, understood. So what was the fallout of that? How did that play out? What did that mean for you as a faculty member? And now you're writing and you know, speaking with various news outlets, contrary to a majority of at least the honors professors. I mean, how have things been for you? Yeah. I guess I should even ask, like, what protections do you have? Are you tenured, or how, what's the state mm-hmm. of faculty and all that? And what's your freedom to speak?
Well, I am tenured. I'm full professor. So I've gone through the stages of getting tenure, then being promoted to full professor. So I do have that protection, but at the same time, it's not carte blanche protection to say anything. You got to be careful to be respectful still. And that's really what happens with the radical left, is they label any disagreement as hate speech. And so the way that they'll, of course, they'll always say they're for free speech, but the way they get around it is by saying, we're for free speech, but not hate speech. Mm-hmm. And the biblical view of marriage is hate speech. Mm-hmm. And so it's not as simple as saying, well, they're against free speech. Well, no, and no one at ASU is going to say we're against free speech. Mm-hmm. But what counts? What are you allowed to defend? So I've been speaking up more, just to, as I said, on my Substack. I'm trying to alert parents and potential students and pastors in the West Valley, mm-hmm. where my campus is, that this is the kind of thing, this is how Christians are spoken about by these professors. And so you need to know that before you send your students to ASU West. It's not neutral. And it's definitely not friendly. They might have known that, but it's not neutral either. It's hostile. Mm-hmm. And the proof is in the kinds of things, the kinds of events we see. So this, the same honors program that was opposed to Dennis Prager speaking hosted an event about why witchcraft is beneficial.
Yeah.
It wasn't a history of witchcraft.
Double standards. Yeah.
It was about why it's beneficial, why it helps promote feminism.
Mm-hmm. So we're today going to get into a variety of things. I don't want to jump there yet. I want to keep talking about this, but I want to bring in some other ideas because I think it's interesting in terms of trying to understand our current cultural moment. But I'm more interested to try to understand our current intellectual moment in the United States specifically, but also just in the Western world. We're living in a different world. There's a lot of books. Many books have been written. I'm reading one presently by Joseph Minnick called The Bulwarks of Unbelief, which is published by Lexham. That has a foreword by Carl Truman in his book, mm-hmm. The Rise and Fall of the Triumph of the Modern Self, is certainly, I'm butchering the title, but his more recent fuller length work deals with a lot of this. And both of those works interact quite a bit with Charles Taylor's imaginary, his philosophy and understanding of cultural imaginary and the way that we think as cultures in terms of what is plausible to us, and why Carl was so interested to try to understand why the phrase, you know, I'm a woman trapped in a man's body, makes sense now, but to his grandfather would be completely nonsensical, like to his grandfather's time, generation, culture, that they would have no way to conceptualize what that even means. It's just a nonsensical phrase. Okay, so this is the point in terms of my thought. Yes. So my question for you in your studies, because you've done a tremendous amount of work in philosophy, or primarily professor of philosophy and religious studies, but you're also looking at freedom of speech. You're looking at the history of the United States, our Constitution, our Bill of Rights. There's so many things for us to get into today regarding natural religion, natural theology, natural revelation, reason, all of these kinds of things. But the tactic that you mentioned that the left is so keen to use is to label positions they don't like, or contrary positions, positions that rather upset them, to label them as hate speech, or to give terms to their opponents, such as, you know, blank phobic, you know, homophobic.
Yeah, right. Phobias.
Phobias, which we can't base everything on etymology or the origin of our words from foreign words. But if I know my Greek correctly, phobos is fear. So homophobia, you know, etymologically, which again is not always the most sound thing to do, would literally mean fear of the same, which is not at all what religious people believe. They just have a disagreement in terms of what's right, but it's viewed as a
true
fear.
And false.
True or false. Exactly. They have a view of, but rather people need to be cast in terms of you're either afraid or you hate. There's no category for disagree or for believe that God has said otherwise, you know? So
yeah, just,
in terms of history,
maybe something's immoral.
Precisely. So if you have the belief that something's immoral, that and there's no that that can't just stand. So I'm wondering, when has this come about? Has this, in your studies, been the case from years ago, from philosophy past, mm-hmm. where opponents are categorized this way? It doesn't seem to me that this has always been the same type of tactic in the public square, but maybe I'm totally wrong.
No, I do think it's new, this casting your enemy as afraid mm-hmm. and hateful. I think those are new, maybe last 15, 20 years, but they grow out of themes in postmodernism that have been here probably since just after World War II. So we're seeing a trend that's kind of coming to flower now, and we have to ask, what root did it come out of? I have a book. I'm looking around at all the books to find my book, because I have a book, The Natural Moral Law, and I don't have a copy with me here.
Mm.
My book's titled The Natural Moral Law, The Good After Modernity,
mm-hmm.
with Cambridge University Press from 2012. And that's kind of my book that's on the same subject as Carl Truman's book.
Yeah.
And what I make the case for is the problem isn't what Charles Taylor said, which is disenchantment.
Yeah.
And he kind of casts reason, especially instrumental or practical reason, as one of the villains that kind of disenchanted the world. What I argue in my book is I'm basically taking the Westminster Confession of Faith 1:1, that there are certain things about God that are revealed to everybody through the light of nature and the works of creation and providence.
Mm-hmm.
And we can assess how well we're doing as a culture based on how well we know about those things. So in philosophy, that's called the good, mm-hmm. our highest value. And so our highest value, it should be Westminster Shorter Catechism, question 1, to glorify God and enjoy him forever.
Mm-hmm.
But that's how I assess our problem, is we haven't been doing that, and we've been doing a lot of other things instead. So I also have a declension story, but it's more of a declension from Princeton, old Princeton, to the present. So I have a few books on old Princeton also, and I hold up old Princeton because the goal of Princeton when it began was piety and the knowledge of God. That was the foundation for the rest of what you do at the academy.
Mm.
And so I argue that we've shifted since then to other goals. For example, ASU's goals are practical. We want to be able to solve practical problems that face our society. They have climate change up there, industrial issues, health issues. These are the sort of things we want to solve, all practical. But that, even if we solve those, it doesn't really help us with the bigger question in life, which is, well, what gives my life meaning and purpose and a sense of order? And we've lost the ability at the university to answer that question.
Hmm. Why? What has happened? You know, you mentioned the declension, but also just the secularization of things. What are some of the reasons that you believe that we have, as a culture, lost the ability to not only discuss these things, but seemingly access them? It's not even like plausible for people. That's part of Minnick's book, is that, you know, he's trying to deal with the bulwarks of unbelief, like why atheism now is not only plausible, but it's kind of the default mode for unbelief, whereas previously people would have been, you know, idolaters.
Well, yeah, that's right. I think what happened was secular now means unbelief,
mm-hmm.
whereas the word secular doesn't have to mean that. It just means it pertains to this world. So if the Westminster Confession is right, this world, the secular world, reveals the eternal power and divine nature of God.
Mm-hmm.
And we should know that from this world. So one of the things that has happened is that Christians have allowed secular and religious to be divided. Instead of there being two things, there's natural religion and revealed religion. They've allowed it to be, well, there's revealed religion, but natural religion really doesn't get us very far at all. And so the secular mind, atheism, unbelief, has taken over that realm and made it its own. And that's where a lot of our life is spent. And so a lot of our life, sometimes they call it like a Monday through Saturday versus Sunday.
Yeah.
Monday through Saturday is allowed to be only the realm of unbelief. And so really one of my goals as a scholar is to reclaim that and make the case that the creation and providence reveal God to everybody as well. And we can and should know God.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I think Romans 1 tells us that we're inexcusable because we don't know God through his works of creation.
Yeah, well, yeah. I, you know, take that to mean that all, you know, all men know God, but suppress the truth and unrighteousness. We're all humans are created in the image of God, and therefore have a sense and awareness of their Creator and their obligation to Him. But whether or not we submit to Him is another question that requires regeneration post fall. I'm curious to get some terms in order because this is exciting to talk about, and a lot of what we're going to talk about today, even with regard to the current events, gets touched on in this Cambridge Companion to the First Amendment and Religious Liberty. That's the book before us and a chapter here by Owen Anderson. And this book is co-edited by Owen Anderson, our guest today, as well as Michael Breidenbach or Breidenbach. And, but you mentioned, yes, so there it is on camera. Yes, thank you. And you mentioned natural religion. We've talked about natural revelation. Sometimes people talk about natural philosophy and those sorts of things, but I realize we're even going to talk about presuppositional thinking, but there's different senses in which we might speak about those. Why don't, you know, I'm not a trained philosopher, but I think, you know, at least in the analytic tradition, it's always really important to get our terms correctly.
Yeah,
so I wonder if you might introduce a few of those so that we can get on the same page with this field, which overlaps a lot with our typical topics at Reform Forum, but sometimes some of these terms get used a little bit differently when we're speaking in the philosophical world.
Yeah. So, for example, I was mentioning general revelation.
Sure.
And general revelation is God's works of creation and then upholding and ruling in history.
Mm-hmm.
And the study of those things is referred to as natural theology.
Mm-hmm.
So natural theology is the body of work that comes out of studying general revelation. And then revealed religion, scripture is the Bible, the Word of God. And so that's given special revelations given, and it especially has redemptive content. So it deals with the reality of sin and our need for God to redeem us and how God's going to do that through Christ.
Mm-hmm.
So those are the two big pieces I'm talking about. And the idea that the secular realm, which means that the world has become just the domain of atheism, unbelief.
Mm-hmm.
I view that as one of the significant problems. And the solution, this is why I differ with Charles Taylor. I don't think the solution is to go back to a kind of we're currently disillusioned. We need to be illusioned again or brought back into the idea of medieval theology.
Yeah. Right.
My thinking is, well, we actually have the tools. We have some really good theology coming out of Princeton. I'm a big fan of Charles Hodge, mm-hmm. Benjamin Warfield. And the problem isn't that we were using reason and we became modernized that way, and we weren't using our fantasy life enough. The problem is that we allowed atheism to take over the word reason, so that religious people are categorized as the irrational ones. And if you want to be rational, you want to make sense, you study science in the mm-hmm. sense of atheistic science. And I think that's really been where we as Christians can step up and reclaim this area and say, no, the world reveals God. It glorifies God in all the things that he's done. And I think that's why some philosophers apologists, I should say, like Francis Schaeffer, he was really good on this.
Mm-hmm.
People critique maybe some of his specific ways he understood this or that philosopher. But overall, his idea was all of culture reveals something about God. And he's getting that from Abraham Kuyper.
Yeah.
And saying all these areas of life really belong to God, and we need to reclaim those for Christ.
Amen. Yeah, there's no neutrality. We can still hold to a secular realm. We can hold to a public square. We could even be, Christians involved in a pluralistic society, but that's different than being upholders or fans or supporters of atheism for some reason.
Yeah, neutral. I agree. So I think that's a big. Mm-hmm. I'd make a distinction between neutral, and common ground.
Sure.
So there's no neutrality. There are correct answers and there are false answers, but there's common ground that we all have. The light of nature and the works of creation and providence that God's given to everybody that they should use to know God.
Mm-hmm.
And so we should be able to say to the unbeliever, we should be able to point out, look, you've rejected God, and there's some really standard ways they do it.
Mm-hmm.
The biggest, most common one is the problem of evil.
Mm-hmm.
So you'll have a brilliant, by the world standard, a brilliant scientist like Stephen Hawking, who can figure out calculus in his mind without even having to write it down. And so you'll ask him, why don't you believe in God? And he might give a few things about the universe. But when it comes down to it, he'll say, look, I was struck with this illness.
Mm-hmm.
I can't believe in God because of the problem of evil. So it almost always comes down to that. And that's one of my other books. I wrote what I called a philosophical commentary on Job.
Yeah.
Because I think Job, I make the case that Job really is the very first philosophy book. I think it's a dialogue. It's superior in my mind to any of the Greek dialogues. Mm. And it goes through the most important questions that all of us ask mm-hmm. as humans.
Yeah, it's rich. I've been reading that in my, it's come up recently and just working through now yeah. the end of Job in my daily reading, as I read through the Bible every year. That's yep. been on my plate, and I've been reminded of that myself.
Yeah, I call him I think he's the first philosopher.
yep. Well, yes, I guess it would depend on how we use it. Maybe as a discipline, yes. Mm-hmm. As a lover of wisdom, yep. we hope yep. many other people did before him. But but sure, then we yeah. don't but even know when Job lived for real. So
yep. yeah. who knows? But in terms of the first book about this material,
absolutely.
He's predating whatever the Greeks
were. I'm pulling
doing.
Your chain. Absolutely. Yep. Yeah, absolutely. There's no doubt about it. So, oh man, there are many threads I want to pull. I'm trying to get in my mind straight. So forgive me if I don't yep. pull the right one to pull next, because I want to get to some constructive things before we get into the weeds. But at yeah. this point, I'm wondering if it might not be worth having a brief discussion about the noetic effects of sin and what sin does to the mind yeah. and the will. Yep. Yes, I agree entirely that God reveals himself clearly. He's revealed himself, even his invisible attributes are clearly perceived yeah. from the foundation of the world. So there's nothing to be perceived that doesn't reveal God in one exactly. way. So I'll just put it that way. So, but at the same time, when apologists, evangelists, philosophers, whatever, politicians, you name it, we go to the public square and we make our case. We can make a true, not only a valid, but a sound case
yep.
based on natural revelation and natural theology, which would be our, you know, theological reflection and construction based on that revelation. All of that is well and good. We can make that case, but the prospect of it being received and adopted is not,
yep.
in my experience, which is anecdotal, is mm-hmm. not high. The prospects are
yeah,
not high.
That's true.
Because there, we have, you know, humans are fallen in their sin, and people yep. prefer to be the Lord of their own universe, yep. so to speak. And so that's what I think Romans is getting at partially, talking about yep. people suppressing the truth and unrighteousness. So I'm curious if you take that any way you want to go, talking yep. about that and or right reason given Princeton, but I'm yep. also interested in how this intersects with, you know, the American, the founding fathers and the natural religion and philosophy that was there in terms of their
yeah.
latent common sense realism. But you run with it. You're the professor. I'll set the table for you and we'll go from there.
I think especially in the Reformed world, that's a really important question.
Sure.
My first book was about Abraham Kuyper and Benjamin Warfield's debate on this issue.
Yeah.
About apologetics, because mm-hmm. Kuyper would say apologetics are helpful for Christians who are yeah. already believers.
Right.
But precisely because of the need for regeneration, they're not of any use right. otherwise. And Warfield disagreed about that. So I think that's a fascinating. I still remember the day I found out about this. I was at my school's gym mm-hmm. listening to a lecture by R.C. Sproul.
Mm-hmm.
And he mentioned this debate. I said, I got to learn more about that debate, because he just mentioned it. He didn't go into it. I said, I got to learn more. What was Abraham Kuyper arguing? What was Warfield arguing? Mm-hmm. And so I think that really illustrates the issues for Reformed people. And it might especially illustrate the difference between the Dutch school and the Scottish Reformation, which is also interesting in its own way. The differences that came out between those two schools in understanding the effects of the fall and human reasoning.
Mm-hmm.
So I teach logic. And one way I illustrate to my class that people aren't logical, so touching your point, that you can give a great argument in the public square, a sound argument, and people will say, so? I don't yeah. believe that. The way I prove that is that Madison Avenue doesn't require you to use logic in commercials. In fact,
not at all. It's more effective not to.
It's a fallacy. Yeah, it's just the opposite, right? To sell something, you have to have a fallacy. So people don't use logic. So that, now I don't think that excuses us, but it's just to say it tampers your expectations as you go into the public square. And so I think I just use examples out of the book of Acts. Our job is to present a sound case.
Mm-hmm.
The Holy Spirit is involved in regeneration or not, who mm-hmm. hears or who doesn't. So when Paul goes and talks to the Athenian philosophers, it seems like the majority of them made fun of him. And a few believed.
Oh, yeah.
It wasn't a large group that believed.
No, no.
But nevertheless, I think what he gave in that chapter of 17 of Acts is one of the best examples of Christian philosophy there is.
I think so.
See that as a calling to us to say, hey, you should live up to that same example, knowing that unbelievers may respond by saying, who is this seed picker?
Exactly. And what's really compelling and interesting to me, and I'm not the first to say this, but other colleagues, friends, Lane Tipton, Greg Bonson before him, but Lane has written, my friend, a chapter on this in Revelation and Reason. What Paul does there, it's important to note that he also doesn't provide some syllogisms or logical proofs or even evidences and hand them over and allow people to interpret them according to their own devices or their own philosophical worldview. He provided the denotation, you know, namely the resurrection, the fact that Jesus was raised from the dead, but then also he provided the proper connotation in terms of what that means. Because Epicureans, Stoics, you know, they would not necessarily have any problem with the fact that a man would rise from the dead. It might just be a really weird swerve in the atoms. But if not given the proper connotation as well, then we can also fail in terms of our apologetic. So the connotation needs to come along with the denotation. So that's important.
Yeah, that is a good thing to know, that Paul there, he goes from a kind of philosophical reasoning about God, the creator, and all of us coming from one man. But then he does become a preacher at one point where he's declaring. So declaring the gospel to these philosophers. And I think, unfortunately, we do divide that. I'm not so sure it's a big problem for philosophers to declare the gospel. Maybe we should do more of that.
Maybe so. Maybe so. So what is, have you noticed in your 21 years of being a professor at Arizona State, a shift in student body in terms of what people are receptive to as you're teaching religious studies and philosophy and talking about these particular issues? Has there been a decided change in the way that the average student thinks and interprets things?
You know what? I'm not so sure if the students have changed. I think the kinds of problems I deal with in class are really universal. Like my philosophy 101 class, we just start off by asking, does life make any sense? And the student responses have remained about the same, which is most of the time they say, not really. And the reason why it doesn't make sense is because it's just full of suffering. You know, you can't do much about it. And they might say, I'm here to get a good job, to get make good money, but that may or may not work out. So those are pretty universal. But the shift I've seen is in the faculty advocacy of what I'll call radical leftist agendas. So it's always been multiculturalism, which I personally has never bothered me, in the sense that I've always wanted to study all the different religions, all the different belief systems. But we've gone now from multiculturalism, which tried to have neutrality. You and I might agree there's no neutrality, but they tried to be neutral, basically. But we've gone now to where they're not even pretending. Certain religions, particularly Christianity and religious Judaism, are wrong. And they've been ruling in history up until the present, oppressing people. And so now they need to be oppressed,
right?
And kind of shown what it's like. So that's a shift that I've seen, which is why I've been speaking out. It really started for me about 3 years ago when my school asked us to decolonize our classrooms. And I said, no, I'm not going to do that. Decolonization is a specific philosophy that especially comes out of South America. And it's Marxist. It's basically like the social side of liberation theology. And so it'd be like saying to a theology professor, make your class more liberation theology friendly. So I said, no, I'm not going to decolonize it. What's fascinating, though, is that I already probably had the most diverse class in my school. And I critique the Greek philosophers pretty hard. I think a lot of guys in the Reformed world are kind of coming around and saying, hey, I really like Aristotle or Plato. I generally critique them pretty hard. So someone might already consider me to have been decolonized by those standards, that I'm not just pushing Greek philosophy as the best thing ever. But this, the idea of telling professors that they need to adopt an explicitly Marxist philosophy, is unheard of.
Yeah. And just in terms of academic diversity and the whole point of having tenure, you would imagine, is so that you have the protections to follow the research and your inquiry wherever it may lead, even if that's inconvenient for the institution. I mean, and so to dictate a particular type of, well, pedagogy is one thing, but just the actual content is,
well, I think
wild.
The explanation, I think, is that humans need to have some sense of purpose and morality. And in this, what we'll call social or cultural Marxism, they don't have anything like what Christianity offers. And so all they can do is they can try to say of themselves, I'm helping the downtrodden, which incidentally, I think, comes from Christianity. But, you know, we argue about that. Where Marx got his values, I think, is actually from Christianity, taking to certain things about helping the poor and getting rid of God and all the rest of the stuff.
Yeah.
But so what they're willing to say is that this is our moral standard. And if you don't live up to this moral standard, you're being unethical. And so there is the possibility there where they could bring charges against a professor because he doesn't hold to this moral standard. He's and therefore he's bigoted.
Mm-hmm. You know, the word of the decade is woke, right? And I know that gets abused, and especially by the right, we'll use that term in some ways to the same way that the left will use the term fascist just to label anything they don't like. Oh, that guy's woke. Or on the other side, oh, that they're fascists. Well, okay. So I in my using of the word, I recognize that it could definitely be misunderstood or abused. But there definitely seems to be this understanding that, you know, there whoever's in power or has been dominant for a long time, it's impossible for a member of that group to be particularly oppressed themselves. So me and you, we're of a very privileged class. We're Americans. We're white. Yeah. We're men.
They call it whiteness.
We're Christians. So like we're checking all the bad boxes of intersectionality. And it's then for some of this mindset, as far as I understand or I've seen or interacted with people, it would be impossible for me to be the victim of racism. Because
by definition, you can't be.
Right. Well, could you explain that and how that might intersect with, you know, our cultural mindset? Because that comes that comes back round to, I think, some of the reason that these presidents were very unwilling to say that any people calling for genocide are committing an aggression, because they're typically considered, you know, minority groups that are oppressed themselves. So it ends up becoming this kind of like a categorical conflict in their mind. So it's a meltdown in the firmware.
Yeah, exactly. Self-contradiction they have to work through. Well, I think what it comes out of is the first few lines of the Communist Manifesto, that all of history has been a history of conflict between oppressors and oppressed.
Right.
So the Communist Manifesto is looking at capital, but this group has expanded that to gender and race and cultural background. So it looks to see who's oppressing who, and that's the only moral standard they have. And so up until the present, you name the list of what they call intersectionality, and they call it whiteness. Whiteness has been in charge and oppressing everyone else. And so now we need to flip that. And we need to do that in a number of ways. We give people who have been oppressed before extra advantages.
Sure.
Maybe we take away some of the advantages from whiteness.
Yeah.
And that allows there to be a switch. And if the switch overcorrects, meaning that people who used to be oppressors are now themselves experience oppression, that's not bad, because maybe that overcorrects. Maybe that makes up for some of the oppression in the past.
And then we start the process again.
Yeah. I mean, and so that's what we saw in these three presidents. I should say, for everyone listening, look up Ben Sasse has an article out in The Atlantic. He's a former senator. Now he's president of Florida State.
No, Florida.
And so he's writing.
Florida. The Gators.
Florida. Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Out in Arizona, I got to keep those straight.
Yeah.
But he's writing as a university president, and he's got a great critique of these three Ivy League presidents. But then also look up the Chronicle of Higher Education, because it has two articles defending those presidents, and one of them is about why moral clarity is a problem. And the other one, it's just what? And the other one is about how they answered perfectly because they answered as academics, which means they had to qualify everything. They couldn't give a straight answer.
Right.
And those two ideas kind of go together.
Yeah.
There's no clear moral standard for us. So we just have to do the best we can. And we don't want to have what that article said is we don't want simple answers. Mm-hmm. Everything's difficult and confusing. And really, that's the heart of academic skepticism. We have that name because the academy that Plato started descended into skepticism. So now we just call it academic skepticism. And I think that's the opposite in the realm of belief and unbelief. It's the opposite, again, of what the confession starts with, or what Paul's saying in Romans 1. Because there we're saying there are some clear things, and they are simple. They're not that complex. Clear things, true things about God that we should all know. And what Ben Sass makes the point of saying is that the universities like Princeton and Yale and Harvard used to believe that. This is another one of my books, Reason and Faith at Early Princeton.
Yes.
And I made that point earlier in our conversation. There's some things that we should know about God and have piety towards God. And the idea now at Harvard, if you had to say it teaches anything about piety, it teaches impiety. Yeah. Right? You shouldn't be pious.
Well, that brings up, I was in our previous conversation in October, I had recently heard a conversation with, I don't know if it was the founder or certainly one of the people running FIRE, which is, what is it?
Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression.
Exactly. And so the FIRE has published a guide to free speech on campus, but they regularly update this where they have a ranking of campuses that are, in terms of, it's like college football rankings. They rank them in terms of free speech. And Harvard is often at the bottom of the list. In fact, they get a negative score because they do certain things that penalize them so poorly. But most all
ASU
the
doesn't
Ivy
do
Leagues,
well either.
Yeah, that's too bad. Well, that's what I was going to ask you. I mean, oddly enough, one of the locals here, the U of Chicago, is actually usually pretty high. And
well, they are because they have the Chicago Statement is called, which is the Chicago Statement on Free Speech.
Yeah. So what's going on in terms of, the academy?
Another article for everyone to look up in the Chronicle of Higher Education is by two of my colleagues last month. And I write about this on my Substack as well. They wrote an article in there about how free speech is used to get money influence into the academy. But they name the kind of money they're worried about, because if you just said that, you might have something. You know, big businesses try to influence the academy by giving money to the universities. Okay,
of course.
That could be a problem. But they went further. Right-wing money is what they're worried about. They're not worried about George Soros. He can give all the money he wants. They're worried about right-wing money. And they said freedom of speech is code word, and it's misused by the right wing. And that kind of answers the question, like, why is there a problem for free speech? Because the left realizes if you have free speech really means free debate.
Yes.
You can offer your argument. I offer my argument. The left doesn't have arguments. They have this phobia stuff, which is not an argument. Mm-hmm. And so they're going to lose that. Mm-hmm. And so they need to shut down free speech. And Dennis Prager said this when he was out, because he ended up having that event last year at ASU. And he said his assessment is the reason why people don't want him speaking on campuses is in 1 hour, he can undo 4 years of liberal education.
Right.
I think there's something to that.
Yeah, it's a phobia.
Well, you know what he said? Because Charlie Kirk came out first and introduced Dennis Prager. And Charlie Kirk, is maybe 8 to 10 minutes. Most of that was spent on why you should keep the Sabbath holy. Then Dennis Prager comes out. And his big thing was take responsibility for yourself and honor your mother and father.
Yeah.
Those are the things these scary right wingers are saying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And clearly this is problematic.
Yeah. Right. They didn't tell you who to vote for. It wasn't like a political thing at all, but it was keep the Sabbath holy, honor your parents.
Right. So let's get to, on this point, let's get to some of the principles and the intellectual history that you and philosophy that you write about in your contributed chapter to the Cambridge Companion to the First Amendment and to religious liberty. This is really important. Obviously we have in America, maybe it's not obvious, maybe not everyone understands this, or a lot of people haven't had civics class or forgot it or it wasn't ever good to begin with. But we have a freedom of speech, but as that's been interpreted by the Supreme Court over the years, we don't have a freedom to say anything we want, anywhere we want. And there's also this added layer where people, are saying, I'm on Twitter. I can say whatever I want on Twitter and Twitter can't censor me because of freedom of speech. No, they're a private company. I mean, it's publicly traded, used to be a publicly traded company, but it's still a private company because it's not state run. So it's a business and they have the right to, censor what's on their platform. People have questions about that because they also claim to be common carrier. So they claim that they can't censor everything, and then they do censor things. That's a whole other matter.
Yeah.
With the FCC and whatever. We don't need to get into that. But my question is, or at least setting this up, this issue is trying to understand what were the philosophical and religious foundations for Thomas Jefferson and others.
Yeah.
What was going on in their mind? What were their intentions in terms of protecting free speech? Upon what does that First Amendment rest? And that might help us maybe trace the thread eventually to come back around to where we are today and what the problem is.
Yeah. Yeah. This is another book of mine with Cambridge, the Declaration of Independence and God.
Yeah.
And so in this book, I kind of developed this idea you're asking about. What's the role of what of God in American thought and law? And I trace how the concept of God changed through important Supreme Court cases. And that kind of is an example of how American society changed and what it means about God. So it goes from what we might call classical theism down to now we have more like process theology or open theism. And I look at how that was shown in the Supreme Court cases that appeal to God. And so that's just background to say what's behind the First Amendment. Because I know some people would say the First Amendment is bad because Christianity is true. And so we don't need a First Amendment where we have pluralism. We just need Christianity as the basis. But right. I think – go ahead.
No, I was going to say right. I mean, there's a particular – that's a sliver of a type of a Christian nationalist argument. And that's another phrase du jour.
Yeah. Well, I think the idea is, of course, the background is the wars of religion in Europe. And then the English Civil War and other problems with the Church of England. So coming out of that, what the founders recognized was we need the ability to have freedom of discussion and debate about those issues, not so that it goes on forever. I don't see the First Amendment as the end. I see it as a means. You need to have this freedom of debate in order to come to the truth of the matter. And so sometimes when you hear it, I think especially by atheists or pluralists, they seem to think, no, you just debate forever. There's no truth at all. Whereas I see it as the ability where we can say, no, these things need to be debated and discussed. And by doing that, we come to know the truth. And that's why I think it's so important for us. But I think one of the sad parts of American history is we haven't used it for that reason.
That's a really interesting distinction. I think very helpful for people to think about that way. So you would say, I don't want to put words in your mouth, it's an honest question, but you would argue then that the religious pluralism we have protected and established in the Constitution and its amendments really is given with the understanding that there's a telos to it, that it's a purpose, that it's moving towards something. It's not meant to be a permanent state, but it provides perhaps the foundation or presupposition or the context within which we could have public debate and discussion and arrive at greater truth, more specific truth.
Exactly. Yeah, really every discipline is like that, right? Medicine is like that.
Sure.
We grow generation after generation, and math is like that. So theology, I believe, is a science that comes to know true things. I'm using words from Charles Hodge here.
Yeah, sure.
The idea being that it's not just personal feelings.
Right.
It's not mysticism. These are real truths. And so we can debate these truths and come to the truth. And that means our generation adds, so the next generation builds from there, et cetera. So I'm always impressed with the Declaration of Independence and how it starts, because it says we hold these truths to be self-evident, and then it says God and is a creator of humans, and because of that, we have certain rights. And I think that's the basis for the idea of a moral law. Now, those are really simple, and we might wish it could be fleshed out more, but I think what it's doing is providing us with the truths that we can then go forward with debating. And what's happened instead is that view of God has been replaced with other views about the ultimate, the metaphysical absolute, et cetera. So I think in that sense, we've gone backwards because we haven't used a really important freedom that we've all been given.
Yeah. Now, to my knowledge, in the chapter in this Cambridge Companion, you don't deal directly with Scottish common sense realism, but is that something that you've dealt with in the past? I mean, as far as I understand, it certainly was a philosophy, if it wasn't, you know, explicitly adopted by many of the founding fathers, it certainly was in the air.
Yeah, I think so. I don't know if your audience would tire me holding up books, but I got another
one. I love it. Bring it on.
Charles Hodge, Reason and Faith in Charles Hodge, where I do look at his view of common sense.
Sure.
Because a good friend of mine, Paul Helseth,
yes,
he and I have discussed this, and I think he's onto something really important, which is that the use of common sense in Princeton wasn't a departure into some other philosophy. What they did was really just standard reformed thought. And so that may or may not be too important for your listeners, but maybe if people who studied Princeton would know that he's kind of challenging Mark Knoll's ideas there. And this idea that Princeton departed in some ways from the reformed tradition. I think Paul's right. It was within, it's defending what's really reformed orthodoxy. So, but at the same time, the word common sense can mean a lot of things. Mm-hmm. So the way I understand its use at Princeton is that there's some things that we can all know and we all should know them. And those form the basis of going on to study everything else. So just take the two words, the two goals, piety and the knowledge of God. You can give arguments to defend those, but those are also just the starting point for the academy. You, as a scholar, that should be your goal. You love God and you want to know more about God.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And clearly, you know, Warfield, one of our heroes, one of our favorite theologians, deals with a lot of this. And then we get into Dr. Helseth's arguments and his work dealing with right reason. And so that's definitely a book that I'm sure a lot of our listeners are definitely going to want to take a look at. We should have a follow-up conversation. Maybe we could do a symposium on this, Owen. We get you.
Yeah.
We get Paul to come on, some
Let's
others.
Do that.
That'd be a fun conversation. Let's work on that. Yep. People can keep me honest and, well, I'm honest, but to keep my feet to the fire to make sure that I'm pursuing that, but I think that'd be a good conversation. So where did the common sense go? If Thomas Jefferson, you know, came through with the DeLorean and showed up today and saw what we were doing in the present, what do you think he would be most surprised by? What would give him most consternation?
Well, in my book on the Declaration of Independence, I have a chapter where I critique Jefferson and Thomas Paine. So the way Thomas Paine has this book, Common Sense, and that kind of illustrates the problem, which is that the common sense, he's saying common sense tells us the Bible's not inspired.
Yeah.
Jesus said a couple moral things, but that's it.
It's
and
not
nature
common.
Is my church. I go outside and I look around and that's where I have church. So he thinks that's what common sense proves. So that's why I think we do have to do more than just asserting some starting points. We need to be able to defend them and show how they're the truth. And so I think at the very beginning of the Common Sense Project, there was that built-in tension. And Thomas Jefferson's on the same side as Thomas Paine. He's saying the same sorts of stuff about the Bible.
Oh, yeah.
And
he's very critical. And I mean, he's famous for having his own version, and he was his own higher critic and cut portions out.
Well, that's what's amazing. I put that on the chapter. All the stuff that you see coming out of Germany 100 years later, you'll find it in seed form in Thomas Jefferson, Thomas Paine. All that higher criticism, they're already doing that same stuff.
So are you arguing that the highest academic production in Germany is really based on American work? Is that what you're
saying? Wouldn't that be funny if it comes around? They're all reading Thomas Jefferson, right? No, but yeah, this I just think that when you read through his critiques of biblical inspiration and what he thinks Jesus said, how he picks out, he's basically picking out the historical Jesus, the quest for the historical Jesus.
I know.
Here's what he really said. Here's what the apostles added on. So on the one hand, you have that. On the other hand, you have Princeton. Mm-hmm. And I think there's this tension that still comes down to the present. And that's what we have the First Amendment for. We should be able to solve this tension. And I've said, I really think that the Westminster Confession 1:1 states the answer. It's a great statement about what's clear about God. We know these things about God, and it's because we have rejected them that we need Scripture as redemptive revelation. Mm-hmm. So we don't allow Thomas Paine to get away with his kind of natural theology deism, because that's one reason Reformed people are afraid of natural theology, is I think they've granted too much to guys like Thomas Paine, and they think natural theology can get you to Thomas Paine, but that's not enough. And my response is to say, no, he didn't do natural theology enough. He barely dabbled in it, but the things he says are inexcusable before God just on the basis of what we should know from natural theology, let alone we can critique him from Scripture. But I think we need to bring back a robust understanding of natural theology.
Yeah, robust. And what are your thoughts on, I don't want to take us too far afield, but your thoughts on special revelation in the public square? As the two are harmonious, natural mm-hmm. revelation and special revelation. I hold to a pre-redemptive special revelation, although an overwhelming majority of special revelation is redemptive in content. But I believe, you know, obviously God established the covenant of works with Adam before the fall. So he's speaking and revealing things about his will in a special way that wasn't ascertainable directly from Adam looking around.
Yeah.
Nevertheless, that's a small but important point, I think. But this gets back to some more current events where we have, you know, people have the Ten Commandments in courthouses, and recently, I forget where it was, but somebody put up some altar to Satan. It was in, I think it was in Iowa of all places.
Yep.
And in a public square, just all this nonsense, where it's one thing to talk about, let's speak about what we can know from nature and let's reason and reflect upon that. But then when we start to bring in, you know, the Bible, which also is true and correct and infallible and applicable to everybody, depending on how you slice and dice that, that is a much more contentious thing to do.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm all for it. I mean, I think that declaring the gospel, preaching the gospel is really important in the public square.
Yeah.
I think, though, that let's say, for example, you look at the larger catechism on the moral law.
Mm-hmm.
How it develops the Ten Commandments. It does this great job of showing how the Ten Commandments are a summary of the moral law, and then how much that moral law is knowable from natural religion, natural theology.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I think that's important is that people in our culture have this really easy dismissal of the Bible, kind of on the common sense ground. They'll say, no, I just live according to common sense. And now that's come to mean things like you were mentioning at the beginning. I'm a woman stuck in a man's body.
Yeah.
That's common sense. And so I think what we need to do is, both from scripture and also general revelation, show, no, that's not consistent at all with the natural revelation of things. And so it takes away both excuses. It's almost like they think they have this area of natural religion as an area to hide in from the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
And no, that area is also God's area. And you don't have any excuse there either. So I think combining them is really good. And sometimes when you put up the Ten Commandments, people will dismiss that and say, well, that's just from the Old Testament. Mm-hmm. Christians might even say that sometimes. Well, that's just Old Testament law.
Right. I know.
The larger catechism, the way it develops the moral law is you really can't get away from it. They can't say, well, that's just Old Testament law. No, this is the law that God gave even Christians to glorify him.
Mm-hmm. We're going to have to follow up with some more conversations on many of these threads, but I want to at least get some trajectory for those who are watching and listening to realize that there's obviously hope. We always trust in Christ, and gates of hell will not prevail over the church, and the Lord is in control. He is sovereign, and he will return, and he will bring final judgment, and will be glorified, et cetera, et cetera. That all is certain. Nevertheless, some people may be wondering, what could we possibly do? Not in a Pelagian sense, but what can we possibly do, or what we do? How do we live? Thinking about we're coming up on an election year. It's only going to get more contentious and crazy. People don't know what's up and down. And then with all of AI and everything, we don't even know. We can't even believe our senses, right? Because everything can be faked. And
are you an AI projection right now?
I could be.
Yeah, I don't know.
Exactly. I could work a lot less if I trained an AI personality to come and do this. But there's, who knows, thousands of hours of my audio out there. It'd be super simple for someone to steal my voice.
Yep.
My sense of humor, not so much. It's hard to degrade it to the level that you would in order to make it most effective and convincing. But honestly, I mean, you're a professor and you're on the front line in many ways, but everyone is on the front line somewhere, you know, and we're dealing with, you know, in our churches with people that come in the door, you know, in our public square, in our neighborhoods, you know, arguing about, I don't know, the sign that goes up in the playground or something like that. There's all of these spaces, touch points. If we're people living in the world, we've got these points of contact with folks, but where do we start when people seem to be at such epistemological and ethical odds that it's hard to even get them to agree on where the point of contact is, which we believe obviously ultimately is in the image of God, but where, you know, where do you begin? Yeah. What do you do?
Well, I can answer that at the big picture level and the smaller picture level. Mm-hmm. So the big picture, they say that, like, you know, the 30,000 foot level picture, yeah, we're looking at the whole landscape. You know, I mentioned my Substack, and I'll have some of my readers sometimes ask me, what's the point? Like, there's one Owen Anderson. There's actually three of us that are writing about this stuff on my campus. I think we have like 7,500 faculty.
No way. Is that all with the global and the distance, or just?
No, that's just, well, we have four campuses in Phoenix.
Okay.
And we have 100,000 plus students.
Oh,
so out of all of that, we have like 7,500, 8,000 faculty, three of us. I know there's other people who are Christians and conservative, but they may not want to speak out because of their job or something. So there's only three people who are able to speak out right now. That's, and on my campus, it's just me. The other two are on a different campus.
Oh my.
So someone could say, what are the odds? I mean, you're not going to make it a difference. You're not going to change anyone's mind. I think that's the wrong way to look at it. I'm not doing it as a kind of a consequentialist utilitarian. Like, if I speak up, mm-hmm, then these things will happen. I'm doing it because it's the right thing to do. Mm-hmm. And you got to speak up and speak the truth. At the end of the day, that's what you need to do is important. But also, I do believe God is sovereign and he can work how he pleases. So it might change people's minds. So from that level, I would say to people, speak the truth. We like movies and stories that are about a small group of people who are rebels. Think about Star Wars, or more recently have Hunger Games.
Yeah.
And you've got people resisting a big, powerful, dark enemy. And we love those kind of stories because I think they're secularized versions of the people of God. And from the very beginning, the people of God have always been outnumbered, on the fringes, up against bad, you know, big odds. And so that shouldn't surprise us. And in fact, we should say, yeah, that's just how it is. And it gives more glory to God because we know that he's the one doing it. Yeah. So for myself, I actually kind of like the fact that you get to speak up in the middle of these times. I heard a sermon by Martin Lloyd-Jones. And he said, so this is the 60s, early 60s. And he said, the times we live in, 60s, is better than the Victorian age. And that might surprise you because in the Victorian age, everyone went to church.
Hmm.
But a lot of those people, he said, weren't Christians. They were just going for social reasons. And that complicated and made it confusing and muddied a lot of issues. Whereas he said, now the lines are clearly drawn. The Christians are in church. The people who aren't Christians aren't in church. And he said for himself, I like living in a day where it's clear like that. And I think ours is even more stark. We live in a day where the lines are drawn. So I'm kind of with Martin Lloyd-Jones on that point.
Mm-hmm.
But I also remember Leonidas.
Mm-hmm.
And his 300. He says, you're going to have a great story to tell. And he's fighting for idols of Sparta.
Yeah.
Right? He's not going to have a great story to tell at all. He's an idolater. But the truth of the matter is, This is what we should expect. This is what we see in the book of Acts. This is what we see with Moses and Pharaoh. So from the big picture, I'd say have hope and trust in the Lord. From the small picture, I'd say get to know what matters to people. So I gave an example from Philosophy 101, and I start off the class by asking, does life make any sense?
Mm-hmm.
And people resonate with questions like that. But if you, in your answer, if you're not able to give a cogent answer yourself, you're not going to get anywhere in your witness.
Yeah.
So you got to know the other person, know what they're concerned with, but then also have a cogent answer.
Yeah. You need to stand on their foundation for the sake of the argument, or we might even say more optimistically for the sake of the conversation. And then ultimately show its faults and the cracks in its foundation, but don't leave people there ever. Bring them over to the foundation of God's truth and the gospel.
Exactly.
And demonstrate the compelling case and the true case of the hope that we have in Jesus Christ. Yeah, I don't think it needs to be more complicated than that. And there is always hope. And I guess, you know, for me, I find comfort, oddly enough, in the fact that knowing that all people do know God and suppress the truth and unrighteousness. So no matter as much as people might say they don't know, they have a conscience. They have an inbuilt, concreated sense of God. And their relation to him, no matter how, it might be really deep down, it might be, you know, barely imperceptible to somebody, but there's always that to which we can appeal, and that any communication of God's truth or appeal to his revelation, which is everywhere around us, all roads point back to him. and people know that. So it might not be pleasant in the meantime, in our conversation, we might be called names or haters or people who have a phobia or afraid or you name it, or we might be imprisoned or fired or whatever. But
we have a lot of freedoms. Right? I mean, we're doing this and neither one of us is worried that the FBI is going to show up afterwards and ask, what were you talking about? Right. We know that we can do this freely.
Right.
But what if you were thrown in prison?
Right.
I always think about John Bunyan.
Yeah.
He's thrown in prison and he writes the second most influential English book in English history. Mm-hmm. The first being, of course, the King James Bible.
Yeah.
So it's like, yeah, I mean, all right, I'll go in prison. I can write all day. So there's really nothing that you can do that nothing can be done to you that you still can't, you know, glorify God and bring praise to him. But yeah, I think the idea of getting to the right questions, everyone has these questions. They think they have answers, or they think they can't have answers. And so being able to help them through that process is really life-changing.
Mm-hmm. Amen. Let's pick this back up, Owen. I really look forward to a future conversation. We'll get working on a potential symposium on the subject of right reason. I think that'd be awesome.
That's a great title too. Yep.
There's a million things that people can follow up with. Perhaps the easiest and most direct way to go is to go to drowenanderson.com, drowenanderson.com. Well, you find links, I presume, to your Substack, and I know all of your books are there, and many of them also are available, some of them for download.
Yep. So you can go there. I have an Amazon authors page. Mm-hmm. And then probably the quickest way, if you just wanted to message me, is on Substack. Go to Substack, Dr. Owen Anderson on Substack, and it provides you the ability to message me right away.
Right. Okay. Well, that's even better. Okay. We'll put links to the all of these things in the episode description to make sure people can follow up. It's been a pleasure, but let me pump at least the book that we ostensibly spoke about primarily, The Cambridge Companion to the First Amendment and Religious Liberty. It's in the Cambridge Companions to Law series, co-edited by Michael Breidenbach and our guest today, Dr. Owen Anderson. Owen, it's been really fun. Thanks so much for taking the time. Yeah, really looked forward to it. This is absolutely delivered, and hopefully we'll be able to follow up soon.
Yep. Thanks again.
You bet. Everyone, take a look at the website, reformedforum.org, for information about what we're up to, as well as links to all the stuff we've mentioned. We have upcoming events. New publications. The easiest way to stay in touch with us, perhaps, is through subscribing to our email newsletter. Links to that are available in the footer and on various pages on our site. But I do want to thank everybody for listening and for watching, and we hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.